Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Julia Galef, and with me as always is my co-host, Massimo Piliucci.
Hi, Julia.
It's a new dawn. So I was about to say, so Massimo, what are we going to talk about today? But actually, I'm introducing that part too. So I'm here with Massimo Piliucci and a special guest who I'll introduce in a moment, at the 4th Annual Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. And I have here a live audience. Come on, guys, make them jealous at home. Woo! So we've just heard two talks here at Nexus, one from Massimo, and the other sort of paired talk from our special guest today, Michael Shermer. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael barely needs an introduction, but he is the executive director of the Skeptic Society, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, author of many best-selling books, columnist for Scientific American, and so on and so on and so forth. Massimo and Michael have both written a fair bit about morality and what science has to say about morality. Massimo, most recently in Answers for Aristotle, his most recently published book, and also in other books and many times on his blog. Michael Shermer has written The Science of Good and Evil, and also written articles and blog posts about morality and science. And in the last few months, Massimo and Michael have had a sprightly but gentlemanly sparring match on the Rationally Speaking blog about their the overlap and disagreement in their views on science and morality. So we're going to delve into that in more detail today. I'll start, for the benefit of listeners at home who haven't just heard your two talks, by having you sort of lay out in just broad strokes what your positions are. If it were up to me, and it is since I'm holding the mic, I would say that in a nutshell, Michael, you would say that science plays a larger role in defining what morality is and how we should think about morality than Massimo would, and that Michael, to sum up, you believe that science can tell us that the goal of morality should be to increase human flourishing, and also science can tell us how to increase human flourishing. Is that a fair summary?
Correct.
Great. And then, Massimo, would you like to lay out your
position? Well, my position is that certainly philosophy and science, in this particular case, moral philosophy, and the types of science that deal with ethical issues are not independent. But I think that science plays a rather minor role. It plays the role of providing us with the basic facts about the human condition. It also plays an important role when it comes to actual policy decisions. So once we have our, you know, ethical discussions and we figure out that we want to do X instead of Y, then I really do think that in terms of, you know, the social policy, actual decision making ought to be heavily informed by science, by fact gathering, by empirical gathering. But I think, yes, I see that science has a much more limited role in the actual ethical decision-making and the ethical reasoning than Michael does. Because to me, ethics is a way of reasoning about things. It's not a way of finding out facts.
So maybe we should dive in by first talking about the role that science plays in defining what morality should be about, or lack of a role, as the case may be. In your talk, Michael, you argued that we know from science certain facts about our nature as humans and as a social creature, and that those facts can inform our understanding of morality. Can you expand on that?
Right. Well, I guess, like in the example of gay marriage that I mentioned, you know, conservatives would argue, well, this you know, degrades the sanctity of marriage, or that it has some kind of negative consequences on child rearing. You know, all other things being equal, wouldn't you agree it's better to have a child raised by a mother and a father than a mother and a mother, or a father and a father, or something? They make arguments like that. So there, at the start, we can evaluate those claims. You know, we can test those claims. As, you know, the American Pediatric Association just came out with a study showing no difference in the effects on children being raised by gay couples versus straight couples. Okay, boom. So that's just a factual. They're just wrong, factually wrong. Done. But to Massimo's point, and maybe to Aristotle's, that once we've debunked those, can we then make the transition to if this is the way you are, then this is the way things ought to be. If you are gay instead of straight and straights have these sets of rights, why should gays not have the same sets of rights since that's in their nature? They're just being true to themselves. It seems to me we can make that transition and just say science tells us the way things actually are and therefore the way they ought to be constitutionally, legally, and so on. I don't see any problem with just making that smooth transition, right, like that.
Well, here's a problem. So, yes, I would agree with you that if, let's say, a conservative makes an argument against gay marriage based on a factual claim, like, oh, well, children of gay couples have significantly more problems than children of heterosexuals, that factual claim clearly is empirical in nature. You can do the science. It's not necessarily that easy to do the science of it because, you know, controlling experiments, doing that sort of stuff with human beings is not easy. But you, in principle, you can certainly answer that question empirically. But during your talk even earlier today, you said a couple of times, you know, well, you know, being gay is a natural condition for certain people. You know, it's not a choice. It follows that they should be allowed to, you know, follow their nature. Well, what if it were a choice? What if instead of being a natural thing, you know, or a genetic thing or whatever you want, is in fact a choice? What if in fact that turned out a deliberate decision of certain people to engage in certain kinds of sexual relationships? Should then they therefore not be allowed to do that because it's not in their nature, it's just a choice? I mean, how would you determine that scientifically?
I'd go for gay conversion therapy in that case. No, just kidding.
I knew you were going there.
Let's see. Well, so I guess we can still get back to whether it's in one's nature or not. That was just one line of inquiry. In that other study I showed about individualist societies where people have more freedom to choose, they're happier. So the freedom to choose leads you to better be able to flourish as an individual. And therefore, as long as there's no harm to other people, then I would argue that the ask first principle, ask the people, what would you like to do? It doesn't harm anybody. Then that would be okay. That would be morally acceptable.
But then, yes, maybe so. But first of all, we're now, I think, left science, and we're getting into ethical reasoning.
Well, I don't know. I just think there's a smooth transition there.
Not as smooth as you think it is. But let's take this example of, well, you ask people, these issues of you ask people. First of all, I looked at the slides you presented and research you presented. And in my book, in Answers for Aristotle, I did look at research on, you know, comparative sociological research of the kind you were mentioning, and actually the results are not quite as straightforward as they may seem. First of all, it is not true that more individualistic societies lead to more flourishing. Actually, it's more social democratic societies that lead to more flourishing.
More which?
Social democratic societies. So things like, you know, Sweden, Denmark.
Social democratic.
Right. So which means that individualism actually has to be tempered by certain things, like a social net, for instance, so certain degrees of, you know, access to education, access to healthcare, all that sort of stuff. So that now those are all empirical issues, of course. But then it turns out that if you ask, you know, let's say if you use your ask principle, the ask principle, you know, what you ask to a majority of people, what do you think that this is the right thing to do or this is not the right thing to do? Well, the answers are culturally dependent and temporally dependent. As it turns out, if you asked apparently a large number of slaves before the Civil War in the United States would have told you that actually slavery was a pretty good condition for them. And so was the case for slaves in ancient Rome. Now, we don't accept those as good answers. A lot of Muslim women today will tell you that the position they find themselves in very conservative countries actually makes them feel better, makes them feel safe, makes them feel accepted, and so on and so forth. And yet, I think that both you and I agree that those are not exactly the best conditions for flourishing for a human being. But now that is no longer an empirical question, because if you simply ask them, you will get a very different answer from what you expect. There was a very interesting article that came out a few weeks ago about China and representing the first case of post-democratic society, flourishing society. Now, I disagree with the author of that article. In fact, I wrote a response that it's about to be published in the Philosopher's Magazine on ethical grounds. But as it turns out, if you ask right now, a majority of Chinese are pretty happy about the way things are going. As long as their material well-being is taken care of, they don't seem to care very much about individuality, freedom, democracy, and so on and so forth. So where does that leave your ask first principle?
They don't know any better. They don't know the choices available. Yes, of course, the slaves in ancient Rome or in 19th century America, or in modern times where you see these interviews with these sister wives, in these polygamous communities. Oh, I love, this is a great idea. Well, they don't know any better. I mean, they were raised since little children that polygamy was normal and having sex with old guys is okay and so forth. But once people know what freedom to choose is like, they almost always choose more freedom, not less freedom.
Well, as I said, that's actually empirically not the case, at least not in most European societies. But the thing is, so you're saying that they need to be educated.
Yes, well, so the arc of the moral universe is bending more toward individual rights and freedoms and less so. And so I'd say that natural trend that we're tracking indicates something. Not only are we tracking it scientifically, but we can say that this is reflecting something about our nature.
Let me interject for a moment. Michael, you've laid out several different principles for how we can decide what's moral. There's the what is natural principle. There's the ask first what do people want to be done to them or not to be done to them principle. And then there's the is it harming anyone principle. I'm curious, in your example so far, it has seemed, to the best of my memory, that all of them can be taken care of with the second two principles, the what do people want and what causes harm. Is there any case where you need the what is natural criterion to decide what is moral? Beyond the other two, I mean?
Can I use a lifeline for this? I'd like to phone a friend.
Well, I can change the question
joking.
A little
no,
bit.
I'm just joking.
Okay.
So, look, I'm not a moral philosopher by training. I'm just trying to, I'm coming at this way. I'm trying to answer the question to theists and theologians and believers, without God, anything goes. No, that's not true. Okay, so then what basis do we have? Well, we have to have some bases. And so the utilitarianism and deontology, virtue ethics, fine, those are all good. But we can do better than that still. We can add all the components I brought up in terms of what science brings to it. We can ask first. We can, it's too easy to rationalize based on some of these collectivist type arguments, the utilitarian type arguments, for why it's okay to harm people. And I think we can do better than that.
Well, first of all,
just adding a few things here.
First of all, it's not actually quite that easy. I mean, modern utilitarianism is, as much as I don't actually endorse it, it's a fairly sophisticated framework for moral philosophy. I mean, just if we had Peter Singer here, he would have quite a bit to say about this. But let me go back to two of your points you just made. First of all, for instance, this idea that you also brought up in your response on the Rationally Speaking blog, that you can show that gods cannot possibly be the source of morality. Well, that's a philosophical argument, and it was made by Plato 2,400 years ago. It's called the Euthyphro Dilemma, and it has absolutely no input from empirical evidence whatsoever. You can make that argument on logic alone, which is what I'm saying is, in fact, the reason why science is relevant, certainly empirical evidence is relevant to moral philosophy, but it doesn't determine it. The other thing is, if you talk about, let's say, utilitarianism, deontology, and virtue ethics as different frameworks, the thing is, once you start looking at empirical answers, you've already made implicitly a decision to adopt one of those or other available philosophical frameworks. For instance, let's take Sam Harris, who you quoted in your talk. Sam thinks that it is self-evident, evidently true, that we should go and increase people's happiness and decrease people's pain. Well, that's utilitarianism. It is not at all self-evident. You have to argue for it. Now, he uses that as a starting point, and that's fair enough, as long as he acknowledges that that starting point was actually arrived at by quite a bit of philosophical reasoning and ethical discussion. If you say, no, this is my starting point, and then from now on, I'm concerned with the practical question of how to implement this framework in actual social policy, then sure, that does come down to a matter of empirical facts.
So it sounded like you did actually have a justification for why increasing, not happiness necessarily, but flourishing, should be the goal of morality, right. And that it was derived from natural selection, right?
Right, correct, right. So, Massimo, so back to my opening example. Would you say that in some cultures, female genital mutilation is moral acceptable? You think it's okay? Or do you say
no,
it's wrong?
No, I don't.
You don't? Why? Well, on what basis?
I don't, because I think that it is not ethical to force, especially a child, especially somebody who cannot actually object to it, to undergo pain for arbitrary reasons that are not useful to the person. It's okay to undergo pain for things that reasons that are not arbitrary and it's good for you. Like, you know, if you have to have an operation to get a tumor out of the way, well, that's going to cause you pain. And if I have to do it on a child, even without her consent, I think that's ethically acceptable. But in that case, I don't. Now, I can give you, as I said, this was the short story. Then we can get into a more complex discussion because in fact, the choice of the child or the welfare of the child is not just as simple as a question of, as a matter of pain or not pain. There is also the societal context. As it turns out, if you don't do it, these children will suffer because they live in a certain society. Now, I still think that that doesn't outweigh the idea that genital mutilation is wrong, so I still think it should be objected to. But there's plenty of other situations where that answer is not quite clear-cut at all, where it does depend on the societal framework. For instance, there is research that, as you know, that shows by social psychologists recently that a major split between conservatives and let's say progressives in the United States has to do with the fact that conservatives count as moral, as part of the moral universe, certain things that progressives don't. Mm-hmm. Issues of purity and, you know, respect for authority and things like that. They think that that is part of the moral framework. I don't. There's no empirical answer to that. To that issue, we have to argue about why exactly is it that
sure
you can? What
kind of empirical evidence? Jonathan Haidt has all this empirical evidence.
I know. I don't like his research.
Well, you're. I think you're wrong on that.
So
in this case,
no.
Like,
go ahead. What would be the answer?
With say, like, take Sam's moral landscape. So maybe there's more than one correct answer. How do we find out which is the right one for you? Ask. So states' rights would be an example of this. Maybe instead of the federal government telling us what to do, the state should have the individual choice, or break it down even further, the community or the city or whatever.
Or so the individual.
Or the individual, right.
So it sounds to me like you want science to justify your democratic libertarian positions, which are really...
No. I'm in favor of the individual. To me, we should have some gun control. That's not a libertarian position. And so that depends on, look, there's no philosophical framework that's going to give us a single answer to all these different social issues. Just take them one by one. And I think we can do better than what you just said about female genital mutilation. I think we can do better than that. Than just saying, well, you know, in Western democratic cultures, it's wrong. But for those other cultures...
That is not at all what I said. I said that it is wrong, period. I just said, however,
well, wait a minute. Wrong, period? How do you know it's wrong?
I think I explained that I think it's wrong to impose pain for arbitrary reasons, because those are arbitrary reasons, as I said, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to cure you of a tumor.
But what are you basing that on? Where you get that?
Then we have that's not based on any empirical evidence whatsoever, because what empirical evidence would that be that people don't want to be feeling pain and want to be feeling pleasure? If that were all the basis to our morality, we can just hook ourselves to a drug machine for the rest of our lives and be very happy and not in pain. Most of us don't think that's a reasonable thing to do.
But
why not?
On the utilitarian calculus, then, just the simple hooked up to the machine kind of pleasure is not enough. There's deeper, richer pleasures that come from, well, the seven different criteria I put up there. Mm-hmm. So it's not just based on the one kind of pleasure. There's multiple kinds of pleasures, some that come from delay of gratification, for example.
Well, a lot of people actually, especially in the United States, would say that delayed gratification is hardly a pleasure at all. That if I could get it all right now, I would. And
yes,
if science allows me to do that,
yes,
I should.
But in the long run, they're not, they harm the society and they harm themselves. They're not better off.
But here's another problem that I have with letting too much room to science in terms of moral decision-making. By the way, I should, again, just in case there is some doubt, I should reiterate that I don't think science is irrelevant. In fact, no moral philosopher thinks science is irrelevant or empirical evidence is irrelevant to these discussions. It's a question of how do we balance things out. So science, the problem with science is science itself changes, sometimes dramatically. And it doesn't always make progress. Sometimes there's some significant regresses. So, for instance, during the 19th century, the dominant position in science, in biology and anthropology in particular, was racist. In the 20th century, early 20th century, there was a fairly widespread scientific position that is known as eugenics, that actually resulted in social policies. The major branch of the eugenics society in the United States was actually right here on Long Island, just a few miles away from New York, and it resulted in laws being in the books for decades and hundreds of thousands of people being forcefully castrated. Mm-hmm. That was science. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, they were wrong.
They were wrong. But they were wrong on what case? According to what criteria?
And so, for example, like today's conservatives are far more liberal than liberals were in the 50s. That's moral progress. Based on what criteria? Based on individual liberty and freedom.
Seriously. Really?
Because are you not aware of this?
I'm not aware of this. In fact, on the contrary, I've been in this country for 23 years. And I found myself reacting in the following way to every election of a Republican president to office. Surely people are not going to be that stupid to elect that guy. And then they are. And then 4 years later, the next guy comes up and I think, you know what? The previous guy was actually fairly reasonable. I think that the political spectrum in the United States has moved dramatically to the right over the last 20 or 30 years.
This is an interesting question, but we have so much stuff that's actually on topic.
Go ahead.
I'm going to set that aside for now.
Stop us.
So there's one thing that I'm still sort of confused about, Michael. For all that science can tell us about human flourishing, it has seemed to me in reading moral philosophy that the philosophical questions and debate begin where the science ends. So, you know, even if we knew completely what would make individuals and societies flourish, we then have all of these questions about trade-offs between my flourishing and your flourishing, or trade-offs between my flourishing and, you know, the greater societal good, or trade-offs between the flourishing of people who exist today and people who are not yet born, I could name a lot more examples, but so how does that reconcile with the fact that you don't seem to place a big role for philosophy in deciding moral questions? Do you think science can answer those trade-off questions?
Maybe. I'm just saying, in addition to philosophy, let's add another arrow to our quiver. Let's use science. Not just for measuring things, but for actually trying to decide what's the right thing to do. Why not add this? It's a great tool. What's wrong with
that? But who is arguing about against adding it? I mean, the argument is against using. No, I don't think so. So we need to be careful about making this distinction. Again, I don't think any reasonable moral philosopher would object to importing empirical evidence, empirical issues into discussions of morality. The question is, how much do those empirical information weigh?
Let's just try it out and see what happens. We can always back off. We can always say, all right, this was a bad idea. Just try it out. Science has worked so well.
We have been trying it out.
Domains.
I mean, you seem to be like Sam Harris, I think, who makes similar arguments. You seem to be under the impression that moral philosophers simply ignore, you know, empirical evidence. Let me back up for a second here. As I said during my talk before this discussion here, the major distinction between science and philosophy, and the reason I do think that they do really both need to work together on these and other issues, is that science deals with the empirical world, and philosophy tends to deal with sort of logical possibilities. And
Let me finish.
So logical possibilities are much broader than empirical possibilities, which is another way to rephrase Julia's question a minute ago, which is science constantly will underdetermine empirically. Empirical information will constantly underdetermine our ethical problems, because our ethical problems are a question of conflict of values. We need to explain to ourselves and to others why is it that certain things need to take priority over others. The empirical information is relevant, but it doesn't determine a unique answer. Even Harris agreed that the moral landscape has more than one peak. But I think his view is very limited. It's not just that there is more than one empirical peak. There is many, many more logical peaks. And so that's why what I think the back and forth is. Now, one of the things I think that is problematic about these discussions, not just about ethics, but about the relationship between philosophy and science in general, is that people on, let's say, I'm not going to put you with this, Michael, but certainly Harris, go on and say things like, anything that deals with facts is science. Well, no. Science is a particular type of human cognitive epistemic endeavor. Science is what biologists do, physicists do, social scientists do, and so on and so forth. It is simply not the fact that if it is a fact, it is science. Last night, for instance, I was watching Louis, an episode of a very funny TV show with Louis C.K. And I can guarantee you that there was no science in doing that. I was simply engaging in a human activity that implied facts. I had a TV. The TV was fed with certain signals. I was enjoying those signals. Certainly there were reactions in my brain that you couldn't measure, but all of that would have been irrelevant. I was just watching TV and having fun. It is not science. If we want to play that game, sometimes expand the definition of science to the entire universe of factual information so that, of course, everything becomes science, then two can play the same game. I can say then, therefore, similarly, philosophy is about everything that it has to do with thinking, which means that we all do philosophy all the time. But clearly, if we expand those definitions that far, we're losing meaning. It's not science anymore. It's not philosophy anymore.
I would say, like, the Enlightenment philosophers, Jefferson and Paine, Franklin, founding fathers, even Locke and so on, they were doing philosophy and science. They just simply did not make the distinction that we make today. So science, your slide, scientia, you know, reason, empiricism, rationality, logic, these are all tools we should use to try to figure out what's the right thing
no
to do.
Disagreement at all there. Okay. But
so
the
I'm
reason
right.
The reason the Enlightenment philosophers were doing both simultaneously is because at the time it was possible to do that both simultaneously. Science was just about to start to differentiate itself from philosophy. Science, of course, was referred to as natural philosophy at the time. Newton thought of himself as a natural philosopher. Descartes, by the way, thought of himself as a physicist mostly. And the reason we remember Newton as a physicist and Descartes as a philosopher is because Newton got the better ideas in physics and Descartes got interesting ideas in philosophy better than Newton's. So after that, however, things diverged. We have specialization. We have, you know, today, as you know, doing science, getting a little bit of really novel knowledge into the store of human knowledge, it's really difficult. It requires a lot of specialization.
I'm sorry.
And it's the same with philosophy.
I want to pull the off-topic card again, because we have about 5 more minutes left. We touched on this earlier, but didn't really explore it, and it seems like a major central issue here. Both of you, you have your disagreements, clearly, but you overlap a lot in your moral intuitions, the way you want to make moral judgments. Human flourishing is central. What do you say to people whose moral intuitions, whose definition of morality does not have very much to do with flourishing? If someone says morality is about purity and it's about, you know, not violating taboos about cleanliness and sex and food and so on, or someone who says morality is just about being loyal to the people in my tribe, I owe nothing to anyone else and can harm them as much as I want. How do you prove them wrong? Can you prove them wrong?
I guess it would just depend on a specific example. I mean, that was a broad swath there. But for example, what you mentioned earlier, Massimo, about how liberals and conservatives differ. So in that case, we may have multiple peaks on the moral landscape in which the reason for these elections to go back and forth and why the pendulum seems to swing back and forth may be because by our very nature, some of us prefer more flexibility and change in our worldview, and some of us are more rigid and hierarchical in our worldview, and you kind of need both so that neither one gets too far in the extreme. So it could be that we evolve naturally this propensity to divide up into these kind of left and right. This is Haidt's argument that, you know, that this may be just driven by our human nature, by just our genetic propensity to have a kind of temperament that prefers, some of us prefer, you know, liberal, and some of us prefer conservative. And so we end up with these kind of parties like this. And so therefore, how do you find out what's the right thing to do? You have an election and see what happens. And then you throw the bums out and you do something different the next time. And so it's like an experiment. You keep changing the variables and run it again, change it again, collect more data, see how it goes, and just keep going.
Although we have different definitions of success, right?
The point here of the Founding Fathers, the way they designed the Constitution, was that nobody knows how to run a country. So we have to set it up such that it's a constant, ongoing experiment. That's science. That's a scientific way of thinking about how best we should live.
See, that's what I lost you right there. It's when you made the leap to that science. Now, that's a lot more complicated than science. If it were science, actually, we could design an experiment very nicely controlled and figure out the answer. We don't. When you were talking a minute ago, I was trying to picture conservative and progressive Neanderthals and how they went about. So, I mean, this whole idea like Haidt does of coming up with just so stories and say, oh, this thing here today evolved because in the Pleistocene, and I make up a story, which as we both know, are stories that are plausible, but plausibility, of course, is not an empirical justification. It's not a scientific justification. We can come up with all sorts of interesting scenarios. There is almost no way to test those scenarios. So I will leave the Pleistocene alone in terms of our understanding. I don't think it really sheds much light on our understanding of why there are differences of values between conservatives and progressives in the United States in the 21st century in a particular human culture.
But the fact remains that there are differences. And people will have different definitions of
right.
What a successful political experiment
now,
is. Right? So how do you reconcile that?
The answer, first of all, that Michael gave you is, as far as I heard, has absolutely, it's very little to do with science. It's not a scientific answer. It's just, he's basically said, well, there are differences in the moral landscape. By the way, those differences are philosophical in nature. They're not empirical. Because it's not that there is any empirical evidence that, let's say, the flag should be sacred. Or that authority should be a value as opposed to just a convenient way of recognizing, organizing things. So these are differences of values. If there's differences of values, then these are differences in ethical landscape, in logical landscape, not in an empirical one. So number one. Number two, all he said was, well, let's vote over and over and see what happens. Well, but that's empirical in the trivial sense that, yes, we're going to find out what people prefer. We're not going to find out what is true or what is best. To do that, we need to engage in a discussion with these people. So we need to have, first of all, start with recognizing, which ethical philosophers have no problem in doing, is that, in fact, there are different ways of thinking about ethics, and that they may be irreconcilable. There are certain things where, well, you know, that is your framework, and unless I can convince you that my framework is better, which is a matter of meta-ethics, by the way, we're getting even further away from science. We're talking about the justification of ethical systems. Unless I can convince you of that, you're not going to change your mind. Now, how do I convince you of that? Well, I might try to, as philosophers say, unpack the context of my way of thinking and your way of thinking. So it turns out that, for instance, my way of phrasing moral issues has a lot to do with harm and rights, and yours has to do with issues like purity or authority. Now, we can have a discussion about why exactly do you think that authority is a value in and of itself? What do you mean by value? Where are you getting these values? Turns out, in a lot of cases, actually, if you really push it, those conservatives will tell you that those values come from religious authority. And there, Michael and I agree. There, they don't stand a chance. Once you push them into that corner, then I whip out my personal copy of Eutyphro's Dilemma, and I say, gotcha. Sorry. You're done.
Does that tend to work, Massimo? Does that tend to work?
Of course not. Just because you can explain, you know, there is a famous widespread quote among teachers, as you probably know, I can explain it to you, I cannot understand it for you. So, you know, there is only so much you can do. But persuasion is a different issue. Now, there, by the way, science does come back sort of the back door, because persuasion really is a psychological issue. I mean, you can be right ethically, you can be right logically. Okay, you can have the right arguments and even the right empirical evidence and not being able to convince people at all. And that's where you want to ask actually the psychologist and say, you know, since I know I'm right, how do I convince these bastards to vote my way?
Am I out of time? I am. Oh, I'm out of time. Any closing remarks?
Got the microphone, so.
Okay, well, then unfortunately, this concludes.
She feels ethically obliged not to exercise her option of keeping the microphone, regardless of what the organizers say.
I don't know. According to utilitarianism, there's a lot more of us than there are of you timekeepers. So, but we didn't actually. We didn't prove that correct. So this, Michael, thank you so much for participating in this conversation, being a guest on our show. It's been a great conversation. This now concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.